Well, some of you are aware that for the last few weeks we've been celebrating a legacy here at Statham Alliance, a rich one. We celebrated 2 weeks ago that Don Bubna had come to our church 40 years ago, and that was a great day together to just hear again what God built into Statham Alliance through his ministry here and the theme of love and unity. And then last week, Morris was back as we acknowledged the fact that 4 years ago this month is when Morris and Ruth moved on and took their ministry in Woodinville. And it was great to hear from Morris again and hear his heart. One comment he made struck me that I believe that God moved me on for me, that God had work he needed to do in my heart that needed a new location. And that was evident in Morris's ministry. And now today, Matt's back and celebrating nothing other than that he's back. Well, you know, no 4 years, no four nothings, but Matt's back. And the good news is it doesn't feel like you've hardly been gone, because you still live in Salem and still call this your home church, and when you're not preaching somewhere else, you're here, and I love that.
I am here.
And still involved in our men's ministry, and it's been good. I have to say publicly one more time that there is nobody that I have ever met that is more loyal than Matt. That he has been the interim senior pastor and accepted a new guy to come in with such grace, never a hint of negative behind the scenes, under the current, you know, anything talk or attitude from Matt. Just completely supportive of this church and my leadership, and that's been huge. I don't know if you ever heard Matt, but one pastor mentioned that when he left, he finally pleased everybody. See, he felt like he pleased some people when he came. He felt like he pleased some people when he was there, and he pleased the rest of them when he left.
That's a good way to look at it.
And Matt, honestly, I don't know of a single person that was pleased when you left. It was just universal disappointment, but a sense that God has led. And so I'm thrilled that you're willing to come back and preach again and go at it.
Thank you,
Frank. Love you, buddy.
Thank you, thank you. Well, this morning is my opportunity to set the record straight. And actually, it's a tremendous honor and a privilege to be a part of Old Fogey Month here at Salem Alliance Church. To be grouped with such special people as Don and Morris is a great honor. I've been thinking about anniversaries in my life. I was thinking about when Don has celebrated his 40 years ago. He started in the pulpit here. And about that same time, I remember my mom, about my third birthday, reminding me it was time to move out of diapers and move on. So anyway, it is truly an honor to be here. For those of you who don't know me, I work with our district office. We are a part of an alliance of churches, Salem Alliances. And our district office, which oversees churches in Washington and Oregon, the Idaho Panhandle, and up in Alaska, is in Canby. So I still live in Kaiser and I'm involved in the life here a little bit and in life in Kaiser a little bit, and drive to Canby when I need to, and I'm on the road a fair amount. We have 107 churches that call themselves a part of this alliance of churches to which we belong. And these days, my involvement primarily is in the area of leadership development, which means that I work with pastors and with leaders, trying to care for them, encourage them, shepherd them, push them on as leaders to become the best leaders they can be. Transition's been very interesting. I listen to the tapes very often from around here. And I listen to the tapes that Don preached and Morris preached the last couple of weeks. And sure miss hearing Fred Clark pray. He prayed for Father's Day. That was a To listen to his prayer was a great event in my life. I miss that a lot. I miss being a part of this group of people on a journey somewhere. And I hope that you never forget the privilege that you have to be in a church where people take seriously as a part of the teaching team to open up the Word every week for those who will listen and those who want to learn. So with that in mind, I got lots to say. You know me well. So grab your Bibles or one from the rack in front of you. And I invite you to turn to the Old Testament book of 2 Kings. It's about a quarter of the way through your Bible. You'll find 1 and 2 Samuel and then 1 and 2 Kings. It's followed by 1 and 2 Chronicles. Find 2 Kings chapter 5. And there's a story that I want you to come to with me this morning. And we're going to take a walk first through the story. And then we're going to seek to apply it to our lives as followers of Jesus Christ. In every group of people, there are three groups who are in attendance when you come to church. There are folks here who are what we might call short-termers. Some of you are folks who have not been following Jesus Christ for very long. This is kind of a new experience, and it's all kind of passionate and new to you. You might be in your first months or your first years of following Jesus Christ, and you might label yourself as a short-termer. I've got a lesson for you this morning. Some of you are long-termers. You've been about this for quite a while. You've been following Jesus Christ for a number of years. It might be decades. I mean, I'm sure there are some here this morning, if I took the time to find out, who have followed Jesus Christ for 70 years and more. Now, I think once you hit about the 4, 5, 6 year mark, you ought to be labeled as a long-termer. And there's a specific lesson for you this morning. And then thirdly, there's some of you who may be here this morning who are guests, or you come with somebody, you came, but you're not really somebody who is into the Jesus thing or a follower of Jesus Christ. You'd make no claims to that. You're happy to be here, or you're unhappy to be here, but you might be labeled as a non-termer. And I have a lesson for you this morning, if I can fit it in before the sermon's done this morning. So come with me to 2 Kings chapter 5, and let's begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 5 of 2 Kings. We begin. Now, Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. Okay, so the Arameans are a group of people who are in the neighborhood of the Israelites, and they're a neighboring country, and they're at war off and on with the Israelites throughout the years. The king of Aram at the time is probably a guy by the name of Ben-Hadad, and this is the commander of his armies. Okay, we meet this man more fully in in the rest of the verse, and it says, he was a great man in the sight of his master, and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. And we learn four things about this commander of this army. Number one, he was a great man in the sight of his master. He was loved by him. He was highly regarded. He was considered to be a great, great commander because God gave him victories. And he was also a valiant soldier individually. But after those four things, there's a big but that ends the verse. And it says, but he had leprosy. And we know from history that the leprosy that we think of might not be exactly what this is. There were a number of different skin diseases in Jesus' day and in this day, which were all put under the same classification. They were skin diseases that could result in anything from blemishes on your skin that were permanent all the way down to a highly contagious and infectious disease that resulted in you being quarantined. Obviously for this man, because he still operated as a commander of the armies, it was one of the lesser skin diseases, but it was embarrassing nonetheless. You come to verse 2 and you meet the second character in our story. And we read, now bands from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, if only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy. So we know a couple of things about this young girl. Number one, she's young. She's probably 10, 11, 12, 13 in that age. And secondly, we know that she is enslaved. She's been taken captive by a group of Arameans who went off in a raid, took her out of Israel, came back and sold her into captivity. But the third thing we know about her is she's one who dreams dreams, one who has visions, one who thought of something that she wanted to see happen in someone else's life. Now listen to what happens as a result. Naaman catches wind of this from his wife, who passes on the slave girl's words. And in verse 4, Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. By all means, the king of Aram replied, I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. To give you an idea, that was about 750 pounds of silver, about 150 pounds of gold that he took along with him as a gift. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, with this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of leprosy. Now, was the king of Israel the one who was curing of leprosy? No, it wasn't. So it's natural that we read in verse 7 that the king freaks the minute he reads the letter. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me. And his first thought is that this letter is a precursor to war, that the king of the Arameans wants to go to war with him. Now, Elisha hears on the street somehow, he's the prophet from Samaria, and he hears in the street somehow that the king is freaked out. And in verse 8 it says, when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. In other words, send him my way, and what has said to be able to take place will actually take place. So Naaman stopped with his horses and chariots, went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan and your flesh will be restored and you will be cleansed. So Naaman arrives in Israel complete with his horses and his chariots and his entourage, and he's sent on to the home of Elisha. He pulls up in front, and Elisha doesn't do what someone in that high position would expect. He doesn't even go out to greet him. He simply sends a message and says, "Go and wash yourself seven times in the Jordan, and you'll be clean." Well, as we read in the next verse, Naaman doesn't respond quite so graciously. But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be cleansed?" So he turned and he went off in a rage. Now, Naaman's servants watch what happened, and they wonder if indeed there is something behind what Elisha has said. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan seven times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, "Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel." This is basically a story about two characters. We'll make it three in the end. But it begins by being a story about a young slave girl and her mistress's husband. And it's about what takes place because this one is in this one's life. It's a story that's 15 verses long on page 326 of my Bible. And that story in and of itself reveals to us at least two and possibly three incredible forces that we dare not underestimate. And it's those three forces that I want to talk to you about this morning. The first force, and perhaps the most important lesson we learn from this story, flows out of something that we catch from the slave girl. Let's call it, for a lack of any other term, let's call it the power of one. Stop and think about it. One of the dominant themes of business literature, and certainly one of the dominant themes of church culture today, is the power of more than one. Rarely a week will go by when someone around here doesn't declare how much we need each other, that we need community, that we need what other people bring to our lives. And we hear it in a variety of ways. There's no I in team. The sum of the parts is greater than the whole. And words like community and accountability and accessibility and authenticity, they all add up to a lifestyle that quite simply works. Together, we do achieve more. But there's a big but in this passage. I want you to stop and think for a moment about that slave girl, because she highlights something that is every bit as important in our lives. Everything about her life has nothing to do with team and everything to do with one. Think about her. How would you like to be ripped out of your homeland, herded into captivity by a band of marauders who enslave you and sell you into a new life, where you suddenly find yourself at the age of 10 or 11 or 12 or 13, all by yourself? You're nothing less than a slave in a foreign land. You're confined to meeting the needs of someone else. No one speaks your language. No one knows your family. No one's met your best friend. No one knows your story. No one cares about the street you grew up on, or what your favorite foods are, or what the songs you love to sing are, or what your family does on special holidays. This young girl's life is defined by a simple, three-letter, one-syllable word, one. One always stands by itself. One can be very lonely. One is individual. One is isolated, and it's all by itself. But some things happen in the place where one stands by themselves. And that